Welcome on to Hollinger & Duncan. We are brought to you today by rockauto.com. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. Welcome on to a special edition of Hollinger & Duncan, our first attempt here on Twitch. And immediately I've messed something up because I forgot to mute my other computer. But now I have done that and we are ready to go. So if this is your first time watching us, I'm Nate Duncan. I host the Dunked On podcast. I'm an ex-lawyer turned salary expert and MBA podcast host. John Hollinger is the godfather of MBA analytics. He used to work for the Memphis Grizzlies and is now kind enough to grace us with his media presence. And let's get started talking about last night, obviously. And I guess this is a reductive question, but the series over?
Boy, I don't think it's over. I mean, we've seen this happen before where we got a little carried away after game one or game two, and then the series turned in an unpredictable way. So I don't want to say it's over. The thing that has to worry you for Miami is not just that they lost or that they lost by a lot, but the injuries that they come out of this game with. Losing Dragic, probably for the series. I mean, now they really got to get something out of Kendrick Nunn, who, I mean, to their credit, they put him out there in the second half and he did some stuff. He kind of looked like, finally, like regular season Kendrick Nunn. So maybe they can get him back on track. But the injury to Adebayo, the injury to Jimmy Butler, you just feel like they're falling apart a little bit physically.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I mean, that's their three best players, right? That we probably can't expect to be the same guys the rest of the series. And I think they could be a lot better defensively for sure, right? Like, I just didn't think they had that great of a strategy defensively. They sure as heck didn't execute it. They've got a lot more wrinkles that they can do. But in terms of scoring, which actually I thought low key was their much bigger problem in game one, they could be in big trouble without those three guys running at absolute top capacity.
Even in the first half, once the Lakers turned the screws, and especially once they took Dwight out of the game and played Davis at five, I mean, the Heat had nothing. There were so many plays where they just kind of swallowed up Dragic coming around the corner, or Hero. Was just very hard for Miami to generate anything in their usual flow. I thought the Lakers did a great job of taking away Duncan Robinson. And even if they made him hit a slipping cutter and that opened something up for the Lakers, it wasn't quite the same thing as having to deal with him splashing down threes. And it left them in a lot of situations where it was just like, okay, Jimmy Butler ISO, I guess, which it was really jarring to see Miami play like that, because that's not usually how they end up.
No, I agree with you. And then when they did run pick and roll, a lot of times it was contested two-pointer. And I mean, they, in the first half, the competitive portion of the game, basically they shot 42% on twos, and they were hitting their threes reasonably well in the first half. Like, that usually you can say, okay, well, we shot really poorly from three, but that wasn't the issue. I mean, they took 20 twos away from the rim in the first half and made six of them, and you could tell, like, those were not like good mid-range shots. That's usually not what the Heat do, really. Other than Dragic, nobody on this team wants to shoot those, maybe Hero a little bit, but they had to shoot a lot of them. Anthony Davis probably contested five or six, and you could see, you agree with me, he was just surprising these Heat players with the level of contest and the length that he was providing on those.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, I mean, coming off of 2 weeks against Daniel Tice and Grant Williams, I think it's just a completely different level of finishing skill and athleticism required against AD in this series.
So that's a big problem. Anything else that really struck you about game one that applies to the rest of the series going forward?
I mean, so there was outlier shooting from the Lakers, and I think there's still the kernel of a good defensive strategy for Miami, which is, we're going to double LeBron and AD, and we're going to make these other Laker players beat us with semi-contested three-pointers. Like, I still think there's a winning strategy in there if they can score enough, and if they can be a little just more locked in. Just, you know, Seth Partnow, who works with me at The Athletic, he always says the number one playoff adjustment is suck less, right? And I think that really... I think that really comes into play there. Like, Miami just didn't play well. Like, just these soft switches, and they just didn't seem nearly as locked in as they had the last two rounds, and the Lakers, to their credit, took advantage of it.
Yeah, I agree. And easily the worst game that they've played from an execution standpoint, particularly a defensive execution standpoint. You had the easy switches, which you mentioned. You had guys helping off the strong side corner for no reason. You had fouls. You had guys not getting into help position the way they needed to. And yeah, it's going to look a lot worse when they go 11 to 17 from three in the first half. And that's a major problem, but you got to deal with that. And the problem was that they also weren't stopping them at the rim, right? Like AD's got 34 points. LeBron is just, they're giving up the low resistance switches. LeBron is just blowing by Duncan Robinson or Hero on those plays. Then they're not helping at the rim. I mean, at least if you're going to switch into that matchup, at least bring enough help that you force LeBron to kick it out to one of these subpar shooters for a three instead of just letting him waltz right to the rim.
Yeah. The non-Adebayo minutes especially were a fire hose of layups, right? And I think they have to really think about how they can get more size on the floor. I don't think you can play Andre Iguodala as a backup five against this team. I think you have to play bigger. Is that Myers Leonard? Is that, I mean, Chris Silva? We haven't heard his name at all. Could he, you know, could he give him some energy here?
Is he like injured or something? Doesn't he have like a hip injury or something? I can't say I was paying the closest attention.
You might be right.
At the top of their rotation, but
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, Iguodala a lot of times was their best help defender, and I thought they really, it didn't hurt them against other teams. We saw it maybe a little bit against the Celtics, but when they switch Bam out on the perimeter, if you compare that with like when the Rockets switch PJ Tucker on the perimeter, or the old Warriors would switch Draymond Green out of the perimeter, Bam just like sticks to whoever he's on after he switches. Like they don't switch back behind the play to put him in help position, and Andre Iguodala did the best he could. He actually stopped LeBron on a couple of drives, but you know, he's not your primary rim protector. Like he's more a secondary guy swiping down from the wing than having to be the main guy at the basket. And so we're probably not crediting the Lakers enough. Particularly, I thought LeBron just came out and had fire in his eyes, and he wasn't going to let them switch these subpar defenders onto him.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some of that. And then some of those sequences around the basket with AD were like varsity versus JV. Right? Had tip to David Thorpe for that observation. But just the sheer size advantage inside, I think that's a real problem for Miami, almost no matter how they line up, especially if you switch with Bam, then you got AD against somebody who's 6 inches shorter and less athletic. It's tough to stop the putback, even if you get the initial miss. So just a lot of problems here for Miami, and I'm not sure how they solve all of them.
So my prediction for the series was Lakers in seven. What was yours beforehand?
I had them in six.
And how would you change that now?
Boy, this has a gentleman's sweep vibe to it, doesn't it?
Sorry, what was that?
Gentleman's sweep, Lakers in five.
Ooh, man, I mean, I might even pick it as a sweep. I mean, I'm going to assume that Dragic isn't going to play or is going to be, you know.
I think he's probably not going to play the rest of this series, or it might almost be worse if he does play, because we've seen that before. The guy says, I'm going to play, and then he comes and plays and sucks, and you would have been better off not playing him.
Do you like both saving money and doing work on your own car? RockAuto.com is for you in that case. Their prices are the same for everybody and are reliably low. They always offer the lowest prices possible. They don't change prices based on what the market will bear, like airlines do. They also have the same prices for do-it-yourselfers as they do for mechanics, unlike many other places. And you have to go to that annoying auto parts store where they're not going to have your part out on the floor. They're probably not going to have it in stock. They're going to have to order it by computer. Well, why don't you just order it yourself on your computer from home at rockauto.com and get better pricing as well? They're a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. You just enter your car in, quickly see all the parts that are available for your vehicle, and choose the brand specifications and prices that you prefer. Go to rockauto.com right now. Make sure you write Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know that you came from us. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need, rockauto.com. Are you dissatisfied with your protein bar? Really think about it. Do you actually look forward to eating that, or you just do it because you have to, and in reality, it tastes like it came from a construction site. Give Built Bar a try. Instead, the improved Built Bar is even more delicious. They're now up to 18 flavors, including nut and non-nut flavors. The new flavors, caramel brownie, cookies and cream, cherry barcia, lemon almond cheesecake, carrot cake, apple almond crisp, and there's the original favorites, of course, like raspberry German chocolate, peanut butter, double chocolate, peanut butter brownie. Lots of chocolate and peanut butter in there, which both of which I happen to love. They're also low calorie, low sugar, high protein, covered in 100% chocolate, high fiber, great for a keto diet. The peanut butter bar, 19 grams of protein, 180 calories, 5 grams of sugar, 5 grams of net carbs. And you can even get a free cooler with purchase while supplies last. Go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON. You'll get $10 off your next order. Use promo code LOCKEDON for $10 off at BuiltBar.com. All right, well, so you guys in the chat here, you watched the game last night. Let's see if we have any questions here that we can hit. Oh, yeah, how about this one from Muggsy B? Which player do you think will have to take on the biggest role after the injury?
Well, clearly Kendrick Nunn to me. I mean, that's the guy, right? If he can be a reasonable facsimile of the player he was in the regular season, then the drop-off isn't that steep from losing Dragic. And then you give the Heat more of a chance to make this a competitive series at that point. But he has to come in and play. I do wonder if they'll start him, actually, in Game 2 and keep Hero in his same role. And that way, it's kind of less of an adjustment across the board for how Spoelstra's using all his minutes and everything. But it's definitely Kendrick Nunn. I mean, he's the most important player for however long Dragic is out. He becomes such a vitally important kind of swing piece, because if he's as bad as he was in the first three rounds, then the Heat are toast. But if he's the guy we saw in Game 1 and the guy we saw in the regular season, then you're like, okay, well, Miami can maybe still do something here.
Parasites Blood Pressure asks Hollinger, why do you hate the Lakers so much?
I think he's referencing the column I wrote today for The Athletic, basically saying that the NBA should be rooting for Miami because their model is much more applicable to about 25 other teams than the Lakers is. But the Lakers are heavy favorites here. I mean, and all, as I mentioned in the column, I mean, all the credit in the world to LeBron and AD. I mean, they hooked up in LA and that's their right and their lives and they're making the most of it.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who never worked in the NBA, I mean, obviously I'm sure many people who worked in the NBA and small Southern markets that aren't free agent destinations, you know, those sort of people might be resentful of how easy it is for a team like the Lakers. Now, of course, the Lakers owners would say, well, hey, we paid more to buy our team than you guys did for this reason. Right. But nonetheless, as a neutral fan and one who's just a fan of good team building, yeah, I don't like to see some of the Lakers' failures get rewarded, to just fail into LeBron and AD and, you know, fail into hiring Magic Johnson and having that be like such a shit show the way it was last year. So, yeah, they definitely did draft well, but obviously, you know, they signed Bozgov and Deng and the whole dysfunction with Jim Buss and Mitch Kupchak. I mean, this is not one of the better run organizations. We did our organization rankings. They're well at the bottom, and now they're going to win just because LeBron James and Anthony Davis wanted to go there because it's in LA and they have all the advantages that they have. So I certainly understand why people who work in the league, you just want to see, like, the whole point of competition is you want the best team to win, and the best players are going to win, but the best front office is not going to win.
Yeah, you know, you definitely feel like you're playing a game where the dice are loaded against you a bit. So I think for 25 or so teams, and especially sort of the 15 smallest slash less desirable for free agent markets, I think that's definitely true.
So shifting from a team that we ranked very low in our organization rankings to one that we ranked very high, but obviously did not do nearly as well as the Lakers, the Clippers moved on from Doc Rivers. Let me ask you this first. The whole narrative was, oh, well, you know, they're parting ways. They decided to do this. Doc Rivers and Steve Ballmer, they had these talks about, you know, the direction of the franchise, and they just decided that they didn't agree on it. So you buy any of that, or did they just fire him? How should we be looking at this?
They pretty much just fired him, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, right? Like, if they said, well, we have these differences, but we want you to stay, he wasn't going to be like, no, right? So, yeah, I mean, you can couch it however you want to, but yeah, they fired him. And it's interesting to me because, I mean, I definitely do think there were some issues there in terms of the locker room and the leadership. And I'm just not sure how much of that is traceable back to Doc. And if you look, I mean, those last three games, I mean, there was a strategic element too, definitely. I mean, he used Harrell more than he should have, didn't play Zubats as much as he should have. But they also just missed a bunch of wide open shots. Right. Yeah. And I think there was a real fatigue element to what was happening to the Clippers in that series that I think was really outside of Doc's control. So seeing him be the fall guy for that is tough. It really goes to show you, though, there are so many different dimensions. I didn't really appreciate this until I worked in the league. There are so many different dimensions on which an NBA coach can get himself fired in terms of, you know, whether it's relationships with the front office, whether it's playoff failures, whether it's, failing to keep the star players happy, whether it's player development, late game strategy. I mean, there are a lot of different elements that go into it. And I think it's one of the reasons why the average shelf life is so short, because there are so many different ways where you can disappoint somebody in terms of being an NBA coach. And there are so many different ways where you can kind of lose the faith of your locker room too. In like several different categories. And then once that happens, it's an avalanche. So you get a sense, really, I mean, with this Doc thing, it really makes you understand how kind of fragile it is for NBA coaches and why why their thinking can often tend to be more short-term focused and why they want so many guaranteed years on their deals.
All right. Yes or no, in the situation that the Clippers are in, would you have moved on from Doc Rivers or not?
I probably would not have. I generally think he's a pretty good coach. And unless I knew that I had somebody that I definitely wanted and definitely thought was better, like unless I already knew who I was getting, it would have been very tough for me to do that. You know, to just say, okay, we're going to open it up and do some interviews and whatnot. Like, you know, but if I really had it lined up where I knew I had my guy, then I might think about it. But to me, he's a top five coach. So you don't move on from that unless you have a known that's like, you know, the question is, who are you getting that's better? You know, Ty Lue, maybe.
So I'm of two minds about it. Obviously, I was shocked by it. As I always say with these coach things, and as you alluded to, deserve ain't got nothing to do with it, right? Like it's just,
totally.
It's not, you say, oh, did this guy deserve to be fired? You're like, okay, did this guy do a bad enough job that he deserved to lose his job? But, you know, a lot of people in normal life, it's like, you got to really screw up to get fired, you know, if you're like a postal worker or something, right? But that's not necessarily how NBA coaching works, because this is the absolute highest level and you feel like there are candidates who can improve. I thought Doc definitely did some things wrong. You're going into next year as one of the highest pressure years in NBA history, given everything that they've traded away and the free agent status of George and Leonard. And so you can say it's definitely a risk to get rid of him. I completely understand that. But you can also say it's a risk to hold on to him, because what if you go into next season and you start off 13-12 and the Warriors are back and the Lakers look good again and Houston's looking pretty good and Denver, and it's like, well, now you just have to fire him and you have to get some assistant, whoever the lead assistant is,
exactly,
off of his bench. And so now you have a chance to really go through the process. This also seems to me like it's kind of the Clippers front office taking things back and doing them the way that they want to do them. And this is a little bit of a power play from them. Doc had a lot of power in the organization. He predated them. There had been a peaceful transfer of power, which, as you know, in this country, we always laud. And between Doc Rivers and the current organization. But still, he wasn't quite on the same page with them. And now they kind of gave away some of their organization to Kawhi as well. And I think they're like, no, we want to get a coach who's back in, who's going to do what we want to do. And, you know, certainly the Raptors did that with Nick Nurse and had success.
Yeah.
And I guess this occurred to me too. How much our coaches just hate Nick Nurse right now, right? Because it's like he and Steve Kerr are like the poster childs for why you should fire a coach.
Yes.
And so like every coach who thinks he's successful and gets fired anyway has got to be like, oh, they think they're getting the next Steve Kerr, Nick Nurse. Like that's why I'm getting fired.
Yeah, totally. And so the unknown with all of this is Kawhi Leonard and Paul George.
Yeah.
I mean, just having been in this situation, it seems unlikely to me that there wasn't some element of temperature taking going on before they went ahead with a move like this, right? And that doesn't mean necessarily that the players pushed for it, but you would think they could have stopped it if it had been important enough to them. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, your colleague Jovan Buha did report that there was some kind of a meeting that took place with Kawhi at a minimum. So before we get to some more questions, where is Doc Rivers the best fit? It was reported he met with the Sixers today, that he and D'Antoni are now the leading candidates after D'Antoni had been reported as the only leading candidate before that. So do you like him in Philly?
Little bit of a weird fit there. I mean, I wonder if he's the guy who can reach Embiid and get him, you know, get the best out of him every night. I do think he's been shown to be a good motivator, although more with kind of underdog teams. You know, that's been his history. His best work, right, has been in Orlando with that team of no names that almost made the playoffs, and then the Clippers 2 years ago. So maybe if he's the guy who can reach Embiid and kind of get him and Simmons more on the same page, I really thought he was going to take a year off. I mean, he's getting paid for 2 years by the Clippers anyway. He'll be hugely in demand wherever he, you know, whenever he decides to put his hat back in the ring. And I don't know, if you're in that situation, like, do you want to deal with next year with all the hoops we're going to have to go through just to have a season and whatnot, and how exhausting this year was? Like, I don't know if I was him, I might chill on the beach for a year and collect my paycheck from the Clippers and then jump back in. But that's just me.
Yeah, he does have 2 years left on his contract at over $7 million per, as was reported. But I think there's some really good openings out there. Houston, Indiana is a playoff team. Like, think of all the playoff teams that moved on from their coaches, and Philly. I mean, you still have two all-stars. Like, how often does that kind of a job?
So that is the unusual. That's the unusual situation. I agree with that. You usually you'll see this many openings in a lot of years. You won't see this many quality openings in terms of, I mean, Brooklyn's already been filled, but you had Brooklyn, Houston, Clippers now, Philly, Indiana, like good teams. And that is rare. I have a feeling he's out of Indy's price range probably. I mean, I assume he's not going anywhere unless he gets close to 10 mil. So, you know, probably out of Houston's too, I would think.
I mean, New Orleans is a great opening.
Like, New Orleans, yeah.
Anything about that even now?
No, we haven't.
They're probably not going to pay that much. But
that's a really interesting one too. You're right.
So all of these coaching contracts have offset language, right? Are there any that don't?
I would be very surprised if an NBA coach did not have offset language. Yeah. Some college coaches don't, because they, you know, their ADs get trucked by the coach agent, but that doesn't happen in the NBA.
Yeah, I agree with you there, but maybe mutual parting of the ways meant, hey, Steve, how about you take that offset language out of my contract before you fire me?
I guarantee that did not happen.
No. Okay. Well, they had extensive conversations, but no, you would know better than me.
I don't think that was in the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, last thing I'll say on Doc is the reason I like him in Philly is just because he has enough of a pedigree. Joel Embiid grew up with Brett Brown. He knew where Brett Brown came from as a coach. And so that's really he's not going to listen to Brett Brown, right? Like, Brett Brown is like his buddy. They built this together. Doc Rivers is a championship coach. He comes in, he's got some gravitas. If Doc Rivers says, hey, you got to get in better shape, Joel. Ben Simmons, you got to shoot threes. Maybe they listen to him when they wouldn't have listened to Brett Brown or, you know, every single person in the media. So Helix Sleep is the best mattress out there. Full stop. In my personal opinion, and the opinion of GQ, Wired Magazine, and Apartment Therapy, all of which awarded it the best number one overall mattress pick of 2020. If you're not familiar with them, they make personalized mattresses here in the US and ship them straight to your door with a free no contact delivery, free returns, and a 100 night sleep trial. So it's basically risk free to you. You fill out their 2 minute sleep quiz and match your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress for you. If you're heavier, if you're lighter, if you like a mattress that's soft or firm, you sleep on your side, your back, your stomach, you sleep hot. There's a specific mattress for each and everybody's unique taste with Helix Sleep. Go to helixsleep.com/PER, take that 2 minute sleep quiz, and they're going to match you to that customized mattress that's going to give you the best sleep of your life. Right now, they are offering up to $200 off all mattress orders. This is the best offer they've ever had. I've been working with them for over 5 years now. Get up to $200 off at helixsleep.com/PER. Easy to remember /PER because John invented it. And make sure you include that /PER link to let them know that you came from us. Let's take a couple of questions on that one. BKI728, does Doc do any better managing the Sixers' personalities or locker room than he's done with these last two Clippers teams?
Well, you say the last two Clippers teams. I mean, the one, I assume you're talking about CP3 and Blake. Because the team 2 years ago, obviously, he did a great job with. The Lob City Clippers, I actually thought, for the most part, they were pretty good. I mean, there were little reports of friction with them even. They had the DeAndre almost left to go to Dallas, and then they had that whole weird episode. But I always thought the story of those Lob City teams was more just like very specific playoff failures more than anything that was a negative over the course of a season. And then there were some own goals too toward the end of that where they really hurt themselves on the back end of the roster with some short-sighted moves. Whereas, this last year was different because they were, like those Lob City Clipper teams, they were always good, but was there ever a year where you were like, oh yeah, the Clippers are, you know, clear favorites and, you know, definitely pencil them into the conference finals at least? Like, it was never quite at that level. And this Clipper team, though, I mean, that it was definitely more of a championship or bust mentality. Maybe they would have left with some dignity if they lost to the Lakers, but certainly anyone else beating them would have been seen as a crushing disappointment, and this Denver series was. So I think that's a very, very different situation. So I'm rambling here, but I guess my takeaway is that I actually thought he did a pretty decent job when he came into that Clipper team and kind of got them on the same page, because they were that last year with Vinny Del Negro. I mean, he definitely upgraded whatever was going on with them from 2014 to 2013, right? And so I think he can do the same thing in Philadelphia, where I do think there was some weird chemistry, and I do think he can help with that.
Can you imagine, just as a quick aside, what it would have looked like if Vinny Del Negro was still the coach during the Donald Sterling affair in 2014? Like, what a shit show that would have been.
Wow. Wow. No, I had not considered that. Good thing we won that series then, huh?
Yeah. This is an interesting comment here from Casta. Doc is getting a lot of mileage out of that loan title at Boston. You think that's true? Is he, you know, that was now 12 years ago. Is he overrated just because of that?
I don't think so. I mean, you forget about 2010, he almost won a second one with a team that was honestly pretty limited.
Absolutely.
And was up double figures in game seven. So I don't agree with that. I thought he
did a great job as recently as the last two seasons before this one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, getting last year's Clippers team as far as they did, you know, and then even in the playoffs, having that huge comeback against Golden State and making it at least sort of a series against a pretty awesome team when they were fully loaded before everyone got hurt. I mean, that was an impressive performance last year.
All right, so let's move on here. We got some mailbag questions left over here on free agency. And here's where I wanted to start. Big Match 3 on Twitter asked, is there a Duncan Robinson, Kendrick Nunn type of potential signing this year?
Just a guy hanging out? Boy, that's tough. We saw a couple guys get picked up right before the bubble restarted. Cameron Payne maybe could be that guy. Played pretty well for Phoenix after they signed him out of the G League. I mean, in general, the Duncan Robinsons and Kendrick Nunns don't happen, right? That's what made this so rare, where you sign a guy toward the end of the season like that, and he comes up the next season and turns out to be fantastic. I'm trying to think who else is out there. You know, the one guy who's sort of interesting, I think, and I haven't seen him sign anywhere. Maybe he signed somewhere overseas and I didn't catch it. But Jayshon Tate had a really good year in the Australian League, and I think he could be a guy that NBA teams look at. Some of the other guys I liked from overseas who kind of fit that mold have already signed contracts for this year and probably aren't going to be available for NBA teams this offseason. But otherwise, I mean, if there's one guy who I think maybe could sort of be like that, I'd probably say Cameron Payne.
Yeah, I got a couple here of guys who, you know, because Duncan Robinson, Kendrick Nunn were in the G League. Robinson was at least a two-way guy. One of the guys I really like a lot is Paul Watson out of Toronto. And he didn't play much at the big league level, but in the last game of the seeding games against the Denver Nuggets, he was awesome. Like, he's got a lot of athleticism. He can get up for some alley-oops and some hard drives, hit some threes. I think he was in the high 30s from three. And I just really was very impressed by him. He's actually on a two-year two-way, but you would think that they would bring him up next year. And they're always looking for more wings off the bench as well. I really liked him a lot. I'm sure you saw him in college. You know, I was asking, like, how did this guy who's this athletic, who can shoot, like, not even get drafted?
Yeah, I think I questioned the shooting part a little more with him.
Yeah.
Saw him in the G League showcase. Like, there's definitely some athleticism there, especially if he can show that he can guard fours, where he's a little undersized, but if he could play as a stretch four, there's probably something there. I didn't get to Fresno State a whole lot, so I actually didn't see him in college. But maybe I'm a little more down on him. I've heard other people talk him up a little more. I was kind of bullish on Rajon Tucker, who signed with Utah, but he didn't really do a lot for the Jazz this year. And I thought maybe he'd play when they got into that playoff series, and they were kind of going with other options ahead of him.
Yeah, he's really athletic, but the shooting seems like it's an issue there. And particularly just in that Utah system, they needed someone who could come in and play a little bit more of a role. I got two other guys for him. I mean, one, and Drew Eubanks is still on a two-way, right?
Yes. Yeah. And
that's your guy.
Oregon State product who played very well as a backup five for the Spurs in the bubble game. So there could be something there. Yeah. I mean, the market for fives is always going to be muted, and he's like a pretty traditional five right now. I think he has to add a little bit more of a skill dimension to his game, but he showed he can be serviceable as a backup five, which, I mean, honestly, for like a two-way guy, that's a win right there. And then we'll see what more they can get out of him in these coming years.
And then the last guy I mentioned I thought was really good this year was Jordan McLaughlin in Minnesota.
Absolutely. Yeah, he did a really good job. He's a free agent. I'm really interested to see if he gets paid above the minimum, because when I model out kind of potential contract values, he comes up as a guy who, you know, should be getting well into the, you know, fours and fives in salary for next year if you project him as a backup one, which I think is a reasonable projection at this point. He got a lot better. He played for Brooklyn's G League team, I think it was the year before, and I mean, like, he was all right, but he didn't scream NBA player either. Was a little small, always had a knack for pick and roll at USC, but I think he's just kind of refined everything to the point where his offensive game is NBA ready.
Yeah, he's got some quickness getting to the basket. I think the shooting is kind of the variable. Is he going to be a 36% guy off the dribble, or is he going to be a little lower than that? Mm-hmm. Next question here. Is there any path to offloading Al Horford?
Yeah, there's a couple that are sort of interesting to me. I mean, the one I floated and the thing I wrote with Eric Horn and Rich Hoffman a week ago, could you do something like Ben Simmons and Al Horford for Chris Paul, Dennis Schroeder, and like three first round picks, two of them being like the unprotected ones that OKC has?
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard to move on from an all-star who's the age of Ben Simmons, you just signed to a max contract. I mean, it seems like whoever the new coach is, they're going to at least try to give him a chance. And obviously, Harris and Horford didn't work. Are they that desperate to move on from Horford that they would include Simmons as well? And just, I mean, the problem I think there is, at least here you can talk yourself into, all right, we're going to be a playoff team for at least the next 5 years with Embiid and Simmons just by having those two guys.
Yeah.
If we go Chris Paul, he might just get injured this year and be done, but he's got 1 or 2 years left maybe. And you're not winning a championship with that team, even if you move Al Horford. So I think they still are hoping that they can get to that level. And although it grows more and more remote by the day as he doesn't develop a jump shot and Embiid, you know, kind of puts on more weight and plays less athletically, there is a hope still that the upside of Simmons and Embiid is high enough. So I personally, I don't think I would be that interested in that one if I were
the underlying reason to do something like that is if you think Embiid is a time bomb physically.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like it. That was sort of their idea in making the Harris trade, but
yeah. The other Horford trade that is at least somewhat interesting to me is Al Horford for Harrison Barnes.
Huh.
I'm not sure if another 4 or 5 totally makes sense for Sac, especially if they still think Marvin Bagley is good. But it's something that, you know, I'd at least think about, right? Might have to be some draft equity involved, but...
All right, let's hit some questions here. This is an interesting one from Sabonis Ilyasova.
Okay.
Man, that's just a charge waiting to happen right there. What happens to NBA scouting reports from years gone by? Are they saved in some archive? When John got to Memphis, was there a dusty scroll with the strengths and weaknesses of Jake Sakalidis?
There were no dusty scrolls. A lot of teams in the early part of this decade really got a lot more serious about automating all of that and filing that stuff away. So like now in Memphis, you could find not a dusty scroll, but probably a dusty thumb drive with all of my, you know, reports from 2013 or whatever. But going back further than that, at least in Memphis, where we were probably later to the game than a lot of teams, there isn't something like that existing where, like, I don't know, you can't go back to like 1995 and see what some scout thought of Scott Williams or something. I mean, there might be like a literal paper filing cabinet somewhere that has that stuff, but you're not going to be able to come up with that in any kind of automated way. More recent stuff, yes, you could if you had access to the team's, you know, database or whatever.
Maltrab asks, I know Nate's thoughts, but was curious for John's thoughts on what you think the Bulls could get for Zach LaVine and who would be willing to trade for him.
Well, I mean, if you were really committed to moving him, your first call would probably be Sacramento because they signed that offer sheet. Now, I know it's a different regime there, but it's still the same owner, right? So there might be some motivation for that.
Interesting.
More generally, like, what are you trying to get out of trading Zach LaVine, I guess? Or like, he's still a pretty young player who can get better still offensively. Like, because really, if you're trading Zach LaVine and you're Chicago, what are you trying to get? You're trying to get somebody else's Zach LaVine, aren't you? I mean, I think you're just better off keeping your own unless somebody's willing to massively overpay.
Well, I do want to see what it would look like with a real coach in there, which LaVine has not really played for in his Chicago tenure. And now, my suspicion is that he's going to continue to be so bad defensively. But, I mean, his two biggest weaknesses are defense and playmaking. And, yeah, I probably would rather just roll the dice on just, like, seeing if he can improve or not. I don't think he's going to, but he's probably your best out to really getting to a playoff level of offense, at least in the short term. Now, it does seem like they're maybe trying to consolidate now since they've got Arturas in there. And, you know, maybe he just wants to build his own thing, and LaVine does only have two more years on his contract as well, right? I mean, maybe they're feeling that a little bit, but
I think this trade line would be the time, right?
Yeah,
if you're going to do it when he has 1.5 years left and the team knows that they have, you know, at least that and can maybe extend him, and you've given yourself half a year with the new coach to really see what you have, I think that would be the point where you'd really have to look hard at it if you're Chicago. But I don't think this offseason is the right timing unless you just have a sitter, unless you just have something that's so juicy that it's like, okay, we have to do this.
So the conception of the deal, I would imagine, would be, all right, we're going to offload him, we'll take on some bad salary and some draft picks, right? I think actually LaVine, the best fit for him would be Philly, where they got plenty of other defenders around him. They need someone who can just create a shot off the dribble and pick and roll. Simmons is a good passer already, so he can help out with some of the playmaking. So, you know, maybe a LaVine for Horford type of thing. And then also that you pick up two first round draft picks from Philly in the future. Something like that would be the conception that I would be thinking of. But again, I like that better for me from Philly's standpoint than the Bulls standpoint.
Yeah, I have a hard time getting excited about that one if I'm Chicago, especially with all the young bigs you're trying to get minutes for there already. Like, what are you doing with Carter and Markkanen at that point?
Carter, Markkanen, and Horford, all those guys maybe in theory could just be your three-man front court, all play together. I mean, I think it'd be more about the draft picks, obviously, than Al Horford himself. But maybe you're just banking on, well, Joel Embiid gets hurt and Philly is not any good. You know, like that's, or maybe you just think that Zach LaVine can go there and sabotage him.
There you go. Trojan horse trade.
Exactly. All right, so let's, we got time for a couple more of these questions here. Let's talk a little Cavs. You hyped to talk a little Cavs here?
Oh, I'm so excited, man.
Oh, yeah. All right. Do you think Andre Drummond will have a trade market considering his player option, which I think he might opt into?
Yeah.
Do you think there will be a trade market for him at $28 million is what he's making next year?
Well, last year, the only trade market for him was Cleveland. So I'm guessing there won't be much of a market for him this year. What they need to do is, I mean, if there's a specific situation where a team needs a big and has a giant contract they want to offload and is willing to give the Cavs draft picks. I mean, that's the scenario you're looking at, right? But you're definitely getting an ugly contract back. And you just got to hope there's picks with it. What about if Philly did Horford for Drummond just to get off the last 2 years of his money?
Well, then you have Drummond and Embiid together. I mean, they could.
No, I mean, they would never play together. I mean, Drummond would start on the rest night for Embiid, and then otherwise he'd be the backup five.
Well, it'd be a great way to build up Joel Embiid's confidence in practice because he just kicks Drummond's ass every time they play.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that wrinkle.
Okay, let's take a couple more questions here from the chat. Nato Perron asks, how likely do you think the Suns making the playoffs next year would be if they got Fred VanVleet? So we could talk just more about that possibility in general here, John, of them getting VanVleet.
Yeah, it's definitely plausible, although I think probably more unlikely than likely, given the amount of room they'll have. And it shuts them off from some other things that they might also need to address. You know, like they can get to like $19 million in room, and you know, which maybe not is enough to get VanVleet. But then also to do that, you're right, you have no Saric, no Kaminsky, no Baines. Like, what are you doing in the front court at that point? I mean, maybe you're able to draft a big at 10, and that player can play for you a little bit. I know they've been able to go small at the four position this year, but to do that over the course of 82 games is a little more difficult to just say, you know, Kelly Oubre and Cam Johnson are our fours this year. So you put yourself in a tight spot there as much as VanVleet would help them. I think either way, I'd see them as kind of roughly 50-50 to make the playoffs next year. I mean, they were great in the bubble games, and we just don't know how much weight to put on that right now. And we just don't know what else Robert Sarver is going to come up with this offseason, let's say, that might hamstring their chances. VanVleet would be a nice get, though. I mean, backup guard situation definitely hurt Phoenix this year. They still have Ricky. Is Fred going there to come off the bench, or is he like, are you going to start Ricky and Fred at the same time, play Booker at three? And
seems a little awkward. I mean, I think you're bringing VanVleet in with the idea that Ricky is going to sunset in some fashion eventually. And he's, whether he becomes a bench guard or you move him, I mean, he struggles to stay healthy. He's getting into his 30s. So they do need a longer term solution at point guard. That's part of why I was critical of that signing to begin with, because it helped them for last year, but you know, how long is that going to continue to help them?
Yeah.
So going back to one thing you said, though, how real is the bubble? I definitely thought that a lot of guys took steps forward. I mean, Booker looked unstoppable. Ayton looked way better defensively. Campaign gave them a lot. But so number one, Campaign, maybe he's taken a step forward and he can solve your backup guard problems, and they have a team option in him for next year that I'm sure they'll exercise. But you know, he was obviously way over his head in that. Also, and of that 8-0 record, I want to say at least three of those games were against teams that just weren't trying in that game.
Yeah. Yep.
So the 8-0 is a little bit deceiving. And then, you know, they had a couple of really close wins as well. They had one over Dallas. They had one over the Clippers that they easily could have lost. So, you know, they more likely could have gone, if everyone were trying, or maybe they had a little bit more average luck, and more of a 5-3 bubble performance there than 8-0, like we're just absolutely dominating. So
yeah.
I think that's not to say that level of play can't continue, but 8-0 does really overstate what they were doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm excited to see them next year, though. And I haven't said that about a lot of Suns teams of late.
No, yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed watching them in the bubble. Absolutely. We did a couple of games with them. We did the Battle of the Undefeateds between the Suns and the Pacers.
All right.
You know, TJ Warren was on fire.
Mikal
Bridges shut him down. Remember that?
Yeah, I did. I actually, I watched that whole game, too. Yeah. I tell you, Bridges... Bridges is a stopper, man. Bridges is, they got something there.
No, I'm really impressed by him. So I got a bunch of questions in the chat. We can close on this here on Victor Oladipo and reporting that he would prefer not to return in Indiana. So presumably that means they aren't going to grant an extension, one would think. And they've got all these other ball handlers there, but he hasn't really looked like himself since returning for the injury. So any fits that you see for him as a possible trade candidate?
It's hard because I think the fits depend in part on whether the receiving team thinks they can re-sign him. And you just don't know the answer to that without knowing some of Oladipo's preferences. So that's where it gets a little challenging. You do wonder about, I mean, Miami's a team that's definitely, his name came up even before everything that happened in the bubble. You could argue they have less need for a two guard now with the way Tyler Hero has performed. But, you know, that I think that that's a name that's going to come up just because they have the room to take his contract in pretty easily. Then the question becomes for Indiana, well, what are you giving them to make it worth their while? Otherwise, I think it really comes down to whether that team thinks they could get him to extend the contract. And obviously, there's a physical dimension, too, of what the receiving team thinks of his physical state, which, to me, I actually thought he looked okay physically and was just like fighting himself and fighting the game a little bit, like kind of forcing shots and doing things that didn't really fit within the flow of the game, which me is maybe a little more fixable.
Yeah, although, like, I thought he looks like he's moving okay, but the big thing that he doesn't have is that explosive finishing at the rim that he had before the injury. I mean, I think he's able to get there a little bit. He's able to create shots. Maybe his jumper is even better, perhaps to his detriment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm really have not been impressed by what I've seen from him because he was so explosive in that 17-18 season. Like, you would try to trap it on the pick and roll and he would just split right through it and be on top of the rim in a flash. And those are the kind of plays. And then he really had struggled every year of his career other than 17-18 finishing at the rim despite his athleticism. And that year he really improved his finishing and now it's back down to being pretty miserable. So I'm definitely concerned about him. I mean, yeah, he might be a nice like 3-and-D player who can do a little bit off the dribble and maybe shoot off the dribble a little bit as a secondary option. But I think your prior at this point has to be he's done as anywhere close to a first option. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, you're looking at him more, especially on a good team. You're looking at him as more like, you know, captain of the second unit and then, you know, a helpful player with your starters.
All right, well, this was fun. Thanks to everyone who interacted on Twitch. We're going to be back doing this now. It's going to be a regular time slot. It's going to be 2:30 Eastern, 11:30 Pacific time on Thursdays. So we're going to be doing the pod then live, twitch.tv/NateDuncanNBA. You can follow or subscribe to us. We're going to start breaking out some subscriber benefits for you over the next couple of weeks as well. So thanks for joining us on this first attempt. And John, you, by being on Twitch, do you realize that you just like got like 10 years younger and cooler?
Oh, I'm so hip now. Yeah, I am no longer washed. This is a huge development.
And if you eliminate the word hip from your vocabulary, you'll get 5 years. All right, guys, this is fun. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk to y'all next week.